my name's Mike Bach. I'm an alcoholic. And it's kind of funny. You're supposed to say, you know, it's an honor to speak, you know, and the guy's in there used to say, I don't really know him that well, you know. But, you know, I did, one of the things I was taught to do when I came to AA is not really listen to so much what people say. You're supposed to listen because it's courteous and everything, but if you really want to find out what people are about in AA, you watch what they do. And I noticed, I've seen Greg around in meetings and stuff, and being from out of town, and he was textbook as to what you should do when you're in a new city or you come somewhere. He got his hand out, he told people where he's from, where, what he was about, he got himself a sponsor. You know, he participated in meetings, and, you know, that's 95% of what it takes to be here and stay sober and be happy. And so I'm honored that you asked, and even though I think you know I'm a Badger fan, and Ohio State's going to lose this weekend. So I want to say congratulations to Joe and thank Monica for speaking and for all the people who picked up chips, and Barbara, congratulations. So, yeah, I got sober on June 3rd of 2003, and what that means to me is that from that day to this one, I haven't had to take a drink or anything else to tune my head, and it is strictly through Alcoholics Anonymous, and what's been shown to me here and what I've done here that has happened, that the God I found here did for me what I could not do for myself, which is basically not only stop drinking, but be happy about that. You know, I came to AA thinking that, you know, it was just going to be going to a series of meetings after my work day instead of going to the bar and bitching about how much it sucked not to drink. And that is the furthest thing from the truth, but that's the only thing I could actually visualize because that's as far as my mind went. My life was defined by drinking. I would love to tell you that it was defined by being a family man or being a good worker or being a son or being a brother or being a successful professional or whatever, but no, I was a drunk. You know, everything else was kind of ancillary. Everything else was background of drinking, and if I take an honest look at it, I mean, everything I did was so I could continue drinking, you know, and I'll get to more of that later. I do have a home group. It's called the Morning Express Group. It meets at 9 o'clock on Saturday mornings at Bayshore Presbyterian Church. It's a step discussion meeting, and my old home group kind of blew up and went bat crazy and all this kind of stuff, and I was looking for a place to go, and something that Melanie, my beautiful bride-to-be, told me is that if people show up at 9 a.m. on Saturday morning for a meeting, they're somewhat serious about AA. And so I started going to this meeting and run into Greg's sponsor a lot and a lot of folks there, and it's been a lot better of a group than I thought it would be. I am sponsored, and I have the privilege of sponsoring two guys right now. So, you know, I did not drink well. I'm 8 years sober. I'm 40 years old now. I don't think I have to tell you which one of those I'm more proud of. And so I got sober when I was 32, and I did 16 years of drinking. And, you know, I like how Monica kind of started off her talk about, you know, figuring out what and all this kind of stuff. And I can, you know, go into, you know, and I have a very similar story. I was raised Catholic and, you know, your jets. I'm not a recovering Catholic or anything like that. I am actually a practicing Catholic today. But I remember having a great home and growing up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and thinking, you know, that, you know, I had a pretty good life here. And I actually had friends growing up. You know, I see my life was spotted with some friends who were very affluent and well-to-do, but I also had friends who, I mean, I know had horrible, went home to horrible households. And in a lot of ways, some of the things that I would say about my folks and about what they made me do, I would compare to those horrible households. And I owe those people, I mean, I almost feel like I owe those people amends for making my experience sound remotely similar to theirs. I never got beat. You know, I got yelled at because I did bad things. And I just, but nothing ever happened to me that said, oh, yeah, it's understandable that he's an alcoholic or that he's a drunk. I mean, there was none of that in my life. My brother went through some really tough stuff growing up, and he didn't have to come to AA to save his life, you know. He's just fine. He's a well-adjusted, normal kid, you know. Kid, he's 38. But, I mean, you know, but I would always point to things to say, that this is why it is, because deep in my heart, as far back as I can remember almost, I knew that my drinking wasn't right. You know, there's always that sort of thing. It's always what I want to do, but I also knew it was completely unacceptable, not only to my parents and to my employers and to the law and to the DAs and to the judges and all that kind of stuff. Other, you know, narrow-minded people had problems with the way I drank. But, I mean, that, you know, that it was really unacceptable to me. You know, I would have those waking moments when I'd come off a bender or something like that, and I just knew I wasn't supposed to be living this way, you know? I mean, this wasn't how it was supposed to be. But what happened when I got drunk for the first time was, you know, like you hear a lot of people say in AA, I mean, you know, I didn't fit in, I felt different, blah, 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 rickety-tick-tick. I mean, I felt like I was missing something that everybody else had, that made life seem easy, that made relationships seem easy, that made work seem easy, that made being a son seem easy. Like that, like, you know, that was left out, you know, and everything became tremendously difficult for me. And, you know, it just seemed as if everybody else had it so easy. And I think, and I got angry at those people. I was jealous of those people. And, I mean, it was probably the furthest thing from the truth. I think everybody, alcoholic or not, has things that they have to struggle with. You know, but I'm so self-centered that I think I'm the only one, right? You know, that no one, you know, and how many times do you hear somebody come into AA and say, nobody understands me, you know, and all this kind of stuff. I mean, and it's because we're so self-centered, or at least I was, that, you know, I didn't think anybody could possibly relate to my problem or understand what was going on with me. And, I think one of the functions of being self-centered, besides thinking that everything is about you, is that you assume the worst about everything and everyone. So everybody's out to get me. Nobody wants me to be happy. My parents have it in for me. They don't care about me. They just care about themselves. All this kind of stuff. It was always the worst about other people. You know, I got an exam coming. I'm going to flunk it. You know, everything was just, I would put the worst possible outcome on everything, and I put the worst possible behaviors on other people. And I come to find in AA that, you know, really what that's about is that I never wanted to face the truth about myself. I never wanted to look inward. Much easier to look outward. Much easier to blame other people, even though I didn't have a solid leg to stand on when I was pointing the finger at somebody. And what made it worse is that I knew that. Deep down inside, I knew it. And the only thing that seemed to make that go away was drinking. And when I drank, everything just got amazing, you know. It was like an answer to all my problems, and you know, and it became so important to me that that's really all I cared about from my first drunk. Now, I don't know when I crossed the line, and I don't, you know, I do know that in my mid-20s, I made my first effort to stop, and I couldn't, and I made several attempts to stop thereafter. I think I was like 25 when I went to my first AA meeting, and I didn't get sober until I was 32. So figure that out. And like everything else, you know, it was a story of progression. At the beginning, it didn't seem like it was that big a deal. Although I got in trouble, it seemed totally worth it. You know, my sponsor today talks about doing a cost-benefit analysis on drinking and how the cost starts here and the benefit's here. And then as you drink, as an alcoholic drinks, it goes like this. And I kind of liken it to if I'm fighting in a prize fight, each round, in the first round of that fight, I'm getting in the ring with a flyweight who can hit me, but it doesn't hurt. But as the rounds go on, I stay the same, or I may be banged up a little bit, but the boxer on the other side goes up a weight class. So by the time I got to the end of my drinking, I'm in the ring with Mike Tyson having my ear bit off. I mean, it's kind of how it felt. I mean, I lost all my resilience. I remember when I was in my 20s, I could bounce back. I mean, you know, I would drink. I had a job for most of my 20s where I would drive a beer truck all day, deliver cakes to all these bars in Washington, D.C., play minor league hockey at night, get plastered after that, get up 6 hours later, go back to work, and do it all over again. And I did that for, well, the hockey part for 3 years, and I did the rest of it for 6 years. And I bounced back like that. I mean, but I'll tell you, when you cross 30, which a lot of you don't know about, your resilience not there, and things started to hurt more. And I used to call into work more, and I became more and more withdrawn. Now, I had, you know, when I really think about it, I mean, you know, the more I tell my story, the more boring it gets. And I remember first telling my story, you know, or talking about, you know, and we go through the highlights, the car wrecks and the law enforcement encounters and the hospital visits and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, but really, I mean, that was some of it, and I had that, but really that was about 10% of my drinking was, you know, these things where I could say, you know, yeah, I ended up in another state, which happened, and all that kind of stuff. But really, that wasn't daily. What was daily was get up, drink, struggle through work so I can drink some more, pass out. Get up, drink, go to work, drink some more, get up, pass out. If I kept on saying that, you guys would all fall asleep. But that's pretty much my story most of the time. And it got to a point, how I was saying earlier that, you know, we all, every now and again in AA, you'll hear somebody and they'll say, you know, they're all judging me, you know, which is total bull, by the way. I mean, if you think you're being judged, just stop. Just stop it. You know, you're not. What's happening, or at least what was happening for me, was that I was judging myself, that I knew what I was doing was wrong. And again, a lot easier to put it on someone else. But, you know, my parents had become fed up with me. You know, I had become pretty close to unemployable by then. I was about to get fired from a job that I had only had for 2 weeks. And for a long time, I had tried to stop drinking. I had just gotten out of, I had just gone through some chemotherapy for some cancer, which I drank during, which was really smart. Recommend it to anybody. And it wasn't after wrecking a car, and it wasn't after getting thrown out of a house, or wasn't waking up in a jail or anything like that, but it was just looking in the mirror one day and hating myself and not really wanting to live anymore. But at the same time, not really wanting to, you know, kill myself. That would involve work, and I didn't really want to do that. You know, I was too scared. And also having this sinking feeling in my stomach that everything everybody had been saying for my entire life was right, that the frustrations that people were no longer shy to share with me, the people that were still in my life that I hadn't burnt up, were right, that when they were saying I was selfish and unreliable and untrustworthy and unpredictable and that I was hurting them, and that it just became too painful to be close to me. You know, I knew all that was right. I used to have tremendous defenses against all that stuff, and I would get in these knockdown, drag-out fights, but I couldn't do that anymore because I knew they were right, and that was my bottom. That's what got me to call the AA Politburo in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and say, hey, I'm a drunk. I got to go to one of those meeting things. And they sent me to a club, which was very nice and very pretty and had leather couches and people who had nice cars and were all decked out and well-to-do and put together. And I immediately didn't feel like I belonged there. And I would find that no matter what meeting I went to in the beginning. I mean, I go to a meeting down in the core of Milwaukee, and, you know, I say, well, I'm not that bad. And, you know, I go back up to this meeting and say, you guys are a bunch of sissies, and go back and forth. And, you know, and I would pick out things that I knew I could fight against, that I knew that I could, you know, that I could look at and say, you guys don't know what you're talking about. There's an old guy there who wouldn't, no matter what the topic was, He would use an analogy which involved baking banana bread. The fourth step is like baking banana bread, and I'd just be like, and I'd either get really angry or I'd be like, you know, and just want to, you know, smack the guy, or, you know, I would just be like, you know what? I don't have anywhere else to go. I came to AA because I didn't have anywhere else to go. I didn't have, you know, some bright light come up on me and say, you know, oh my God, AA is my home or anything like that. I did not respond to AA well when I got here. And I mean, the greatest thing about AA in my estimation, even to this very day, is that you don't have to have right motives to be here. As a matter of fact, I'd be surprised if you did. No one comes here and says, well, I want to fit myself to be of maximum service to God and fellows. People come in here because they have nowhere else to go, because their ass is on fire, because they're trying to beat a charge, whatever it may be. And I have found through my experience, my own personal experience, and my experience just being in AA and listening to other people's stories, is that it doesn't matter why the hell you come here. No one cares. What we care about is what you do when we get here. And so I'm bouncing around a little bit. And like I said, I'm going to this clubhouse mainly because it's close. And, you know, I don't... I hear every now and again in AA that, well, you know, these certain meetings get people drunk. Such a pile of crap, you know. Now, if I had to characterize the meetings that I went to when I first got here, there was very little discussion of alcoholism. There's very little discussion of steps. They read out of, you know, what people call non-conference approved literature. You know, like they read these meditations from like Swans on the Pond or some title like that, and like, you know, and I didn't relate much, and people would talk about what my sponsor would later call luxury problems quite often and all that kind of stuff. But I'll tell you, if you want to get sober, you're going to gravitate toward those who can help you. And if you don't, if you want to screw around, if you're just trying to get somebody off your back or whatever it may be, and that's the only thing that's keeping you here, if you come here really with, not saying that you have to have right motives necessarily, but, I mean, if you're about not drinking, you will gravitate toward the people that can help you. You may not like them, and that was my case. I had all these people give me phone numbers and say, hey, you want to come out to lunch and all this kind of stuff? And I'm like, you know, and I was just like, you know, get the hell away from me. I mean, I don't like you. But everybody was very, very nice. And the guy who got me was wow. I mean, the guy who would be my sponsor for my first 3 years was not nice at all, you know. The nicest he was when he first talked to me. And then once I said, okay, I'll show up tomorrow, he was over. You know, it was totally over. And the only reason I talked to that guy is because up in Milwaukee, after every meeting, and people have heard me talk about this, and it drives me nuts to this very day, every time that, you know, if I have an opportunity to go back home, I dread this part of going to AA up there, is after the Our Father, and you say the worky-worky thing, everybody hugs one another. Everybody. Like, you go around the room and hug. And so, you know, and I mean, I'm just thinking, and I'm you know, I'm like Bill Weber crazy at this point when I'm new. I'm like, when I'm new, I'm thinking like, when if this person hugs me, you know, I can just spin around and it'll be all over. And I was that angry, and I felt that out of place, and I just hated that part of it. And the reason I talked to the guy who would be my sponsor is because when it came to be huggy time, he stuck his hand out. I'm like, thank God there's not somebody who's a complete joik around here. And he said, you want to talk? And I said, anything, just get me out of here before that fat guy hugs me. And I'll tell you, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, hearing the right things and all that kind of stuff. But what really got me about this guy, I mean, like I said, he wasn't very nice. He told me a lot of things that I didn't want to hear. And but he was right. And there's a line in the book, and I'm not at all a big book thumper, but it's something I think of every time. It's kind of like it's what I aspire to. When I try to work with others and carry the message of AI, and it says, his whole deportment, that's a fancy word for behavior, shouts at the man that he's a man with a real answer, that he has a real answer, something like that. And that's exactly how my first sponsor was. And he just knew everything about me, you know. You know, a guy who was influential in my sobriety at the beginning, also, you know, said, you know, once you tell somebody you're an alcoholic, you're telling them 95% of what they need to know about you. That all the stuff that you think important is actually bull. You know, what's important is that you're an alcoholic. And he described things to me in a way that I had never heard anyone else say before. And I had been to counselors and therapists and, you know, the guys with horn rimmed glasses and ponytails and cardigans saying, do you like you? You know, but it's what Dr. Bob's story said. It's that he talked my language. And so what he would do, it's just one time after the other, is say, after he's done talking to me and I related, he said, meet me for a meeting tomorrow. And then he said, we're going to do these things. And, you know, he went above and beyond. I mean, sometimes we say, you know, well, I can only do this. And I never heard my sponsor ever say, I'm only going to go this far. My sponsor, you know, never pulled me out of a bar or anything like that, but he definitely dragged me along the ear. I mean, And I think I had a bit of willing, you know, the door to willingness or whatever catchphrase you want to use was a little bit open when I got here, and he basically kicked it the rest of the way open. And I'm grateful for that. I hated it at the time. And he would impress upon me these little things to do. And as time went on, I began to appreciate alcoholism. And there was one day when I got sick of getting dragged by my ear to do something or yelled at or screamed at by my sponsor or his sponsor or somebody like that. That happened a lot when I was new. You know, they'd just be like, you don't know what you're talking about, shut up, you know. And then they'd say, and then they'd point to another guy saying, okay, it's your turn to share. And the guy would be like, is that going to happen to me? You know, but as time went on, I learned about alcoholism in a way that it was heart deep, that it was not just something intellectual or anything like that, but I realized this is who I was. And one day I was at this job, which I was about to lose, and I was cussing up. I wasn't cussing at my sponsor, but I was yelling, I was complaining about my sponsor to somebody else. Turns out the guy who just started the day before, a black guy named Carl Gates from Mississippi, who was awesome, was sitting in a cubicle across, and he had just started there a couple days ago. And he heard me bitching and all this kind of stuff, and when I got off the phone, he said, Buck, let's go out and have a cigarette. And so he talked to me, and he said he'd 12 or 50 years in AA or something like that, and he talked to me, and he said, one day you're going to hear an explosion, and that's your head coming out of your ass. And how that happened for me is that day I went up to the sponsor. Instead of him tracking me down and pushing me who to talk to and all that kind of stuff, I said, what's next? And that's pretty much what I've been doing ever since, is saying what's next. And when I do that, and I put aside all the things that I think are best for me, my plans and all this kind of stuff, and I just ask somebody what's next, my life turns out pretty good. I remember, and I'll close with this, when I was in Washington, D.C., I got into doing some criminal stuff, and I drew attention because I'm an alcoholic. I had this vision that, you know, I would be this, like, kind of like behind-the-scenes criminal, like Kaiser Soze or something like that, that nobody'd pick up on or notice. But, I mean, I was obvious, and so the cops would always pick on me and all that kind of stuff. And they weren't really interested in arresting me, but they did have a tremendous interest in beating the crap out of me on a regular basis. And I remember one time I had given them some lip, you know, which is just inviting for more beating. And they were smacking me around, and I snapped at them, you know, is this what you call justice? And the guy looked down at me, and he said, son, there is no justice. There's just us. And I went, plap, like that. When you live outside the rules, you're no longer protected by them. I remember not playing by the rules and thinking that they're wrong and bucking against authority and all this kind of stuff, but then getting resentful and angry when I wasn't protected by the same rules that I didn't want to follow. I found that when you live in your own world, that is the inevitable result. But when I live in God's world, I'm given a way out of all that stuff. I've yet to get smacked around by the cops since I've been sober, you know? But not only that, I have a life that I really, really want for myself. And maybe nobody here is impressed with it, but that doesn't matter. What I have is what I've really always wanted. And the thing was, I didn't learn it. I didn't learn what I wanted until I got here. And if you're like me, you'll find an answer here. Thanks a lot, guys.
And this is Dr. Bob's last message delivered at the First International Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous in Cleveland, Ohio in 1950. I get a big thrill out of looking over a vast sea of faces like this with the feeling that possibly some small thing I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all have the same problem. We all do the same things. We all get the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you will pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say that I have been in bed 5 of the last 7 months, and my strength has not returned as I would like, so my remarks of necessity will be very brief. But there are two or three things that flash into mind which it would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We understand what love is, and we understand what service is. So let's bear those two things in mind. Let us also remember to guard that erring member of the tongue. And if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing. None of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, take us to a meeting or two, to have done numerous little kind and thoughtful acts on our behalf. So let us never get the degree of smug complacency so that we are not willing to extend or attempt to that help which has been so beneficial to us, to our less fortunate brothers. Thank you very much.